Today is December the 30th, 2020. Welcome to the award-winning Personal Computer Show. I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, Amazon, and other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm on the internet. You can leave us a message with your question or comment at hank@pcradioshow.org. Last month, we had mentioned that there would be an auction on the Apple One in its original box signed by Steve Wozniak. Well, the auction took place about a week ago, and it was astonishing what the item brought in. They separated the item into two packages. One was the Apple One computer in its original box, and the other one was handwritten notes by Apple Steve Wozniak. The handwritten notes by Apple Steve Wozniak was for a prototype of the Apple II home computer that brought in $630,272.50. I don't know how those pennies got in there. During online bidding led by Boston-based RR Auctions between December 10th and December 17th. That comes out to over $27,000 per page of doodles and diagrams about the Apple II's breadboard, which includes 5 pages of circuit schematics and notes on sheets of graph paper, 6 photocopy pages headed bus sources, system timing, display, sync timing, and a whole bunch of other material. And these documents not only help change computers from building-sized behemoths to friendly desktop devices, but likewise usher in the personal computer revolution in April of 1977. The brain dump was accompanied by a signed letter of provenance by Steve Wozniak himself. And this is what he states. These documents, circa 1975, are my original Apple II prototype schematics and programming instructions. They are precious. On these work-in-progress diagrams, you can even see my breadboarding technique, where I go over drawn connections in red as I soldered the wires in. At the time, I favored using purple felt tip pen for writing, so it's interesting to see these notes decades on. The prototype was hand-wired while I was still an engineer at Hewlett-Packard's Advanced Product Division, where I was involved in the design of handheld computers. The buyer, a private collector, wished to remain anonymous. There was another lot, and this one broke record. A fully operational Apple I, housed in a rare original box signed by designer Wozniak, was bought by Rally, an investment platform for rare collectibles, for $736,862. The Apple I was a bare circuit board sold as a kit to be completed by electronics hobbyists. Woz alone designed the hardware, circuit board, designs, and operating system for the computer, and first demonstrated the Apple I at a meeting of the Palo Alto Homebrew Computer Club in July of 1976. Over about 10 months, Jobs and Wozniak produced about 200 Apple I computers and sold 175 of them. The lot had some other retro goodies thrown in alongside the board and signed box, an original Apple cassette interface, an original Apple I operation manual, original Apple cassette interface manual, a vintage Apple I power supply, Datanetix keyboard in a wooden case, and a 1976 Sanyo monitor and Panasonic cassette player. Other highlights from the sale included a Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak signed Battleship keyboard that went for $74,535. As of December 31st, 2020, hey, that's tomorrow, a web technology that's been around for 2 decades will rest in peace. Adobe is killing Flash, and it's about time we all move on. Actually, we already have. Flash has been very popular for many web experiences in the past, especially for online games on sites, but other more secure technologies like HTML5 and JavaScript have all but replaced it. It's actually used in so few instances now for the average consumer nowadays that its passing really has no bearing on most. However, that doesn't stop us from worrying about it. We grew up using Flash, so it's understandable that so many Chromebook owners are curious about how their laptop experience will change in the new year. To be honest, it probably won't be missed. Millions of websites will be affected by the death of Flash. Flash has been riddled with dangerous security vulnerabilities for many, many years, so perhaps this will force developers to get in gear and recreate their web experiences using a more secure, modern technology. As of 2017, when Google announced their roadmap for ridding Chrome of Flash, only 17% of sites worldwide used it, and that number has certainly gone way down over the past 3 years. Of the roughly 2 billion websites that exist today, only about 10 plus million were still using Flash as of April. Some companies, for whatever may be the reason, just haven't transformed their infrastructure, but they literally had years to make the change and just haven't done so. Is it possible that many of these instances are due to the developer abandoning those sites and projects, or do they just don't care about the security of their users enough to do something about it? Meanwhile, Apple stopped relying on Flash a decade ago because Steve Jobs saw the writing on the wall. Mozilla and Google have also renounced support for it as of Chrome 76. Flash content was blocked by default, and it no longer shows in search results since October of this year. So what does this mean for Chromebook users? Well, most of it, if not all of the things you do on your device, will be completely unaffected as we say goodbye to Adobe Flash. Outside of some games, it is unlikely anyone will return their Chromebook as a result. Most primary content providers have announced that they moved on and that they can experience their offering uninterrupted in HTML5. The average person literally won't even notice the difference unless they're visiting some obscure website. This is not just something that affects the Chromebook, it's universal. Windows, macOS, Android, iOS, everyone will be affected by this change. As Flash is being retired, well, if you're in love with a specific Flash game, see if you can download it and try running it in the virtualized Ruffle Flash emulator. Either way, the death of Adobe Flash is great news for the future of the internet. Small drones will be allowed to fly over people and at night in the United States. The FAA said on Monday that small drones will be allowed to fly over people and at night in the United States. This is a significant step towards their use for widespread commercial deliveries. The FAA said its long-awaited rules for the drones, also known as unmanned aerial vehicles, will address security concerns by requiring remote identification technology in most cases to enable the identification from the ground. Previously, small drone operations over people were limited to operations over people who were directly participating in the operation, located under a covered structure or inside a stationary vehicle, unless operators had obtained a waiver from the FAA. The rules will take effect 60 days after publication in the Federal Register in January. Drone manufacturers will have 18 months to begin producing drones with remote ID, and operators will have an additional year to provide remote ID. There are other more complicated rules that allow for operations at night and over people for larger drones in some cases. The new rules make way for the further integration of drones into our airspace by addressing safety and security concerns, said the FAA Administrator Steve Dixon. They get us closer to the day when we will more routinely see drone operations, such as delivery of packages. Companies have been racing to create drone fleets to speed deliveries. The United States has over 1.7 million drone registrations and 203,000 FAA-certified remote pilots. For night operations, the FAA said drones must be equipped with anti-collision lights. The final rules allow operations over moving vehicles in some circumstances. Remote ID is required for all drones weighing 0.25 kilograms or more, but is required for smaller drones under certain circumstances, like flights over open-air assemblies. The new rules eliminate requirements that drones be connected to the internet to transmit location data via radio frequency broadcast. Without the change, drone use could have been barred from use in areas without internet access. The Association for Unmanned Vehicle Systems International said Remote ID will function as a digital license plate for drones. That will enable more complex operations, while operations at night and over people are important steps towards enabling integration of drones into our national airspace. One change, since the rules were first proposed in 2019, requires that small drones not have any exposed rotating parts that would lacerate human skin. UPS, that's the United Postal Service, said in October of last year that it wanted the government's first full approval to operate a drone airline. Last year, Alphabet's Wing, a sister unit of search engine Google, was the first company to get U.S. air carrier certification for single-pilot drone operation. And in August, Amazon Inc. Drone Service received federal approval allowing the retailer to begin testing commercial deliveries through its drone fleet. Walmart said in September it would run a pilot project for delivery of grocery and household products through automated drones, but acknowledged it would be some time before we see millions of packages delivered via drone. American Airlines will resume Boeing 737 MAX passenger flights. American Airlines is the first domestic carrier to resume flights with Boeing 737 MAX after the plane was withdrawn from service more than a year ago. The craft's return to active duty begins with Flight 718, a round trip from Miami to New York. It will be the first time since March of last year that a 737 MAX will run a commercial service in the United States after it was grounded following two fatal crashes. It has, however, already run in other countries, including Brazil, which resumed flying on December the 9th. Boeing 737 MAX was a refresh of its Warhorse 737, a mainstay for short and medium-sized routes across the globe. The aerospace giant needed to update its equipment to better compete with Airbus's A320, which led to the reworking of the existing 737 body. Boeing said that there was so little adaptation time required that pilots didn't need time in a simulator, making it a big sell for airlines looking to saving on training. But the plane's new bigger engines were at risk of making a mid-air stall, something Boeing didn't mention. Instead, it built a software system, Maneuvering Characteristics Augmentation System, MCAS, which would automatically kick in to avoid these stalls. MCAS malfunctioned, however, which led to two deadly crashes, Lion Air Flight 610 and Ethiopian Air Flight 302. A subsequent investigation found that Boeing employees had raised major concerns about the system design and operation, and the FAA added that it had failed in its oversight when originally certifying the plane as safe. After the crashes, the 737 was grounded, with Boeing spending the following 18 months working to fix its problems. This process has turned up a number of additional bugs within the system which have needed their own time to fix, further delaying its return. The FAA recertified the plane in November, and regulators in Europe did the same in October. An American quickly ran a test flight with members of the press on board at the start of December. The airline has affirmed that passengers who do not wish to fly on a 737 MAX will be offered flexible rebooking. A number of other airlines expect to return the 737 MAX to the skies through 2021. With United Airlines planning to resume service in February, Southwest Airlines meanwhile say it will resume at some point in the second quarter of 2021. So at least by June, it remains to be seen. However, if a plane that has been held up as an example of how Boeing's culture has failed and is a broader calamity, will they be able to win over a suspicious public? And here we're talking about product failures caused by software. In a rush to get products out, we are not doing sufficient testing, certifying that things work properly. Can you imagine if Boeing had incorporated Windows 10 in the Boeing 737 MAX? How many people would fly on it? A turning point in the digital revolution. 2020 often refers to hindsight. At the start of this year, 2020, instead of being a headwind, it quickly turned into a tailwind. When the pandemic hit, new markets emerged, demand increased, and the levels of innovation went far beyond what had been forecasted. Life will not return to the old normal. Society has changed, and so has the high-tech industry. Change is often forced, but the effects can be beneficial. It created fundamental changes in how people went about doing things. Obviously, COVID-19 is having a profound impact. Fundamentally, it is accelerating the digital transformation. We will not be going back to the same old normal once the pandemic is abated and hopefully eradicated. The realities of the pandemic have shown us that companies can work efficiently, perhaps even more efficiently, collaboratively, and even economically, worldwide in remote worker presence environments. Companies can reach more people more economically if they have a robust digital presence backed by a robust digital supply chain. When people started to work from home, some people were like, "Oh my gosh, we don't get to see other people." And other people were like, "Oh my gosh, we don't need to see other people." A lot of white-collar workers, when working from the office, are focused on the task at hand and trying to avoid distraction. So some people said that working from home improved productivity. Other people said it is more disruptive because they don't have a clear cadence or rhythm in the work-home pattern. It is not better for all. We also have to acknowledge that those of us with no children or older children have the luxury of potentially being more productive than our colleagues. When COVID-19 hit, office workers picked up their laptops and continued their work at home. With VPNs in place and with Zoom for teleconferencing, work continued without missing a beat, nor a paycheck. Not everyone around us was that fortunate. Moving the workplace meant retrofitting many people's home. COVID-19 has demonstrated a number of tech lessons, realizations, and trends that will be taken forward and beyond. One of those is how people need and want smartphone-like experiences on other consumer devices. While many have been working from home this past year, the pandemic has shown that long-term remote working can be efficient for employees. The gradual return to normality could see greater flexibility in where people work, whether it's a home, office, coffee shop, or even an outdoor space. This is likely to see increased demand for laptops capable of all-day battery life and LTE connectivity. Like our smartphones, as users look for devices that don't need recharging after a few hours of video calls or require a Wi-Fi connection. Shifting the workplace also created a change in focus. Having to move from a physical working environment to more of a virtual environment, almost everybody had to double up on their connectivity equipment. For many, the big issue was bandwidth. Compute on the edge. Compute in the cloud. There's not enough compute. Not enough memory. Not enough connectivity. The shift from working in offices to working from home basically created a drastic spike in all kinds of electronic demand. It doesn't come without a few problems. With so many employees working from home and accessing company networks remotely, the risk for network breaches and malware infections has increased significantly. Homes needed to be upgraded too. Computing equipment were quickly snapped up and sold out. That is driving consumption of the current inventory and accelerates a lot of innovation. Manufacturers are moving ahead to produce the next product generation and do it now, and assumes that there's a demand for compute and for bandwidth. The demand is not going to come down. The clock never turns back. They have started driving the next generation products and going about it much faster. It also started a new kind of upgrade cycle. Consumers have become comfortable with teleconferencing. However, it did make many realize that their laptop doesn't quite match up to their smartphones. Much like all-day battery life, the camera capabilities of smartphones are likely to be taken to other large screen devices, such as laptops and TVs. One of the effects of COVID-19 pandemic is that within a few months it has accelerated adoption of digital tools for remote work, online shopping, and online schooling by a number of years. This has left the electronics industry scrambling to supply the hardware to support these online activities. Changes has accelerated in the medical industry. The unanticipated circumstances of 2020 accelerated the medical community's reliance on electronics. Telehealth, for example, leveraged the power and performance of technology for remote diagnosis, monitoring, and other clinical services. In many situations, it became an essential tool for delivering care safely. It's a leap forward in healthcare services, improving quality and making it accessible to more people while changing the health from an episodic interaction to a constant connection. The rapid increase in demand is stretching the supply lines. Supply chains have been ramped up to match the demand, as well as development of the software. Hardware development, in particular materials developed needed for the next generation, is more difficult to accelerate. Several business changes have been required. This year forced us to develop different approaches to working effectively. We are having virtual lunch meetings, and the limitations imposed during the pandemic made us find new ways to work. Many still miss the physical interaction. Though the virtual conferencing infrastructure has been very helpful to maintain contact, having a large group presence has been very much missed. We were forced to cancel almost all in-person events and settle into a virtual experience. While learning and networking will never fully replace time-honored in-person opportunities for information exchange, but we adapted and carried on. 2020 has been a year like no other. Fear and uncertainty played a role, but as soon as the industry realized that technology was a way to lessen the impact of the pandemic, it not only is recovering, it grew. Innovation became magnified, and companies adapted to new ways they had to conduct business. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Cleaning Server Rooms and Computers.
This is Benjamin Rockwell, and now it's time to get down to business. This is where I give you some of my experience over the years of being an IT professional, and I apply it in a number of different ways. In this case, I would like to talk about something that, well, it's cleanliness. And as we all know, cleanliness is next to, well, yes, of course, we've heard that before. And I'm not going to go down that particular road, but I do want to talk about one experience I had. Now, a few years back, I was part of what we would call a pre-audit team. I was not an auditor. However, I thought like an auditor, and I went around and I did a number of different things for the company I was working for and worked on improving the technology involved. Now, some of the, and not so much technology, but the interactions. One of the things I did was I helped set up a very robust backup plan and tested it, and also went through and said, this is how we prove that we're making the backups. This is the different things we're doing every week, every day, every month, all the way through to say that we're doing backups. But one of the other things I also did was I went into our data center and I audited the data center, the server room, if you will. This is where all of the servers are stacked up. And I went through and I said, okay, that needs to be taken care of. We need to have log sheets here. We need to remove all of these empty boxes. We need to do X, Y, and Z. But one of the things that I came across was that there was a plastic glass cup full of water. Now, I don't know if you know what a server is, but it's a computer, a very expensive computer. And we had racks and racks of these very expensive computers. And one of the things you don't put on top of computers, near computers, is water. See, there's this whole thing. You may be aware, you may not have heard, but electricity and water don't normally mix well. The water will win. The electricity, the electronic item, will lose. So this is something that you don't do in a server room. I want to keep on this same path, though. I want to kind of point out that we, as people, we tend to have food around our computers and drink around our... Look, I'm even guilty of this. Right here, within just a few feet of me, I can reach on over and I have a cup of tea. Okay, it is in a spill-resistant mug. So if I knock this over, a couple of drops may come out. Hopefully they're going to land on my keyboard and hopefully not even that. But hopefully everything will be fine. So I'm guilty of that. But this is something we all need to be very aware of, and we need to take precautionary measures to protect our systems. This means we need to be clean. We need to really remove food and drink from the area of the computers. And that's kind of hard for us. But I want to guide you towards thinking about safer approaches. Am I going to tell you no drinks around the computer? Well, especially since we're working from home and we've got limited space. And yeah, these days many people have the dining room table has a computer on it, as well as there's a computer in the living room and everywhere else around the house. Well, okay, it may not always be practical, but let's look for those spill-proof or spill-resistant mugs. Let's find ways to kind of contain the damage. It doesn't take a lot of liquid to really mess up a computer. I've had that happen before, by the way. Laptop, somebody spilled a nice big huge coffee right on that laptop. And yeah, there was a little bit of smoke and yeah, it wasn't good. But some of the other things that we also need to be doing are looking around and making sure that there are no real hazards to the cleanliness of our computers. One of the biggest things we've always done, everybody has done this. You set up a computer and it's down on the floor. Yes, it's down right on top of the rug, the carpet. And what happens with the carpet? Well, yeah, we vacuum it on a regular basis, but it catches dust. All of the dust falls there, all of the dirt, all of the everything. And that generates dust bunnies inside of the computers. What dust bunnies? Yes, you've seen them before. If you've opened up a computer that's been sitting on the carpet for a matter of a couple of years, 2-3 years, there's little gatherings of dust. Yeah. So you don't want that in the computer. That's a problem. I will tell you that if moisture gets to that, it can short out various electronic items. It creates static electricity. There's a number of different things. You don't want dust in your computer. How do we fix this? I will tell you, one easy way is just making sure that your computer is 4 inches off of that carpet. 2 inches, even still, that's pretty good. And yes, you can get, you know, I mean, we can go the cheap route. I know somebody who uses 2x4s. He set up a little bit of a frame arrangement for his computer, and it lifts it up just that 4 inches. 2x4s set on side, hammered together, all of that. And that's how he handles it. And it works wonderful. And you can do the same thing. Just think through, what are the different hazards around? So, is there liquid? Is there food? Is there dust? Yeah. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Developing a strategy for doing backup of files. What is stored on your computer? How much data, if it was lost forever, would be okay with you? If there's any of it that you don't want to lose, do you have a current backup? A lot of computer users don't really pay much attention to what data is at risk until it's too late. Every computer will eventually stop working. Every hard drive will fail. Even solid-state drives, which are much more reliable than hard drives, will someday stop working. This isn't just theory. Keep in mind that when we talk about the need for backups, consider theft, fire, flood, natural disasters, static electricity, ransomware, and lightning strikes. Some of these may seem extreme, but they happen more often than you'd think. Several of these backup methods won't count for much in these situations. If your external hard drive is plugged into your computer, when lightning strikes and ruins all of your electronics, your backup has just been destroyed along with the computer. More people are now backing up their computer. The Harris Poll delivered a high-level look at the backup frequency among computer owners from the years 2008 through 2018. The percentage of computer owners backing up all their data on their computer has steadily increased over the years from 65% in 2008 to 76% in 2018. That's great. But at the other end of the time spectrum, it's kind of ugly. The percentage of computer owners backing up once a day or more often is only 6% in 2018. There was no change from 2008. A lot has happened in the world of computing in the last couple of years, but at least people are taking backing up their computer a little more seriously. And that's a good thing. For many people, data backup and disaster recovery is not at the forefront of their daily routine. But it's a critical function everyone needs to implement in order to prevent massive data and productivity loss down the road. For many people, it is simply backing up the whole computer system onto an external drive or throw it up into the cloud. This is minimally acceptable, but this does not take into consideration the ready availability and integrity of the data, much less understanding how to do the data recovery. When it comes to your business or personal data, there are questions you need to address. If you need to recover any critical data, you don't want to be asking yourself these questions in hindsight. Or too many of us with computing equipment take a lackadaisical approach when it comes to backups. Most are aware that backups, they are important. But too few take the time to sit down and think a backup strategy through. By asking yourself some simple questions before you begin, you'll be able to set up the appropriate strategy for your needs to secure backups in no time. Here are the questions you must be able to answer before implementing a strategy. Resolve these questions before you even start considering hardware or software options, because this is what will help determine which hardware software components will make up your backup solution. What is your mission critical data? Mission critical means data or systems that you couldn't survive without. Example of these are legal and regulatory documents and work in progress, such as the development in writing a thesis for a graduate degree. It doesn't include the digital photographs and videos you took on a trip or cruise a few years ago. When it comes to backups, prioritizing is the first step towards implementing a truly effective strategy. Identify the data that is static, where changes are infrequent compared to data that is constantly changing, such as the authoring of a manuscript. Prioritize which systems, applications, and data are mission critical. Which are critical, and which are simply desirable. Mission critical means you could not continue to operate without it. This will depend on the specifics of your needs, but generally it will include systems and applications that your day-to-day operations depend on. Critical means you must absolutely be able to recover the information to continue with your business or personal activity. Desirable, on the other hand, means you don't want to lose it, but nobody's going to shed crocodile tears if it does happen. At the end of the day, you will be backing up all of the above, but the frequency and the method by which this is done will depend how important it is. Backups are important. That means you need to be absolutely certain to ensure that they're being properly maintained. You need to have someone also who is trustworthy with your backup strategy as a whole, as well as procedural details on how it is implemented as part of your estate planning. Because when you're no longer around, they'll need to get to your data to settle your estate. When it comes to backups, Ambiguity is something to be avoided at all costs. The same obviously goes for restores and recoveries. How will you ensure your backups are restorable? The answer to this one is simple. Test, test, and test again. Yes, your backup software will probably include some form of backup verification, but the simple truth is there's no substitute for good old-fashioned manual test restore. Simply select a mission-critical backup, access it, run the restore job, and then pay close attention to the results. Whether it's an archival backup or a daily on-site backup, you'll be in much better position when disaster strikes if you know with as close to 100% certainty as possible that it can be restored if required. You should also establish a routine for testing important backups, defining what steps are to be taken and how often it is performed. Testing is easy. Not being able to restore mission-critical backup, that is difficult. What happens if you have a major fire that included backup equipment? This is where a disaster recovery plan comes into play. You do have a disaster recovery plan, don't you? Off-site storage of backup data is important because there's no point in meticulous backups and test restores if the same strategy takes out your main systems, also wipes out all your backups. Whether your off-site backup strategy involves some kind of cloud solution or some trusty old tape backups tucked away in a fireproof, waterproof safe at a different location, as long as they're not in the same place, you're off to a good start. There are some additional concerns that you'll want to consider when it comes to the cloud. Just like there are pros and cons to tape and disk and every other method of off-site backup that you can think of, there are a lot of things to consider when it comes to backups. Many in the industry recommend that a good backup strategy should include the 3-2-1 method. That is to say, 3 copies of anything mission critical, 2 different formats, and 1 off-site backup. How will the strategy scale into the future? Foresight is a wonderful ability, one that hardly any of us can use anywhere near as often as we should. When planning out how to approach backup, it is important to consider not only what's necessary today, which is now, but what will become necessary over the next couple of years. Plan that your data will increase over time. That means its backup requirements will grow to match. And here are some further questions that you should address in order to answer the larger question. Is the backup method that you've chosen able to increase in size? Will your backup selection support the next versions of Windows? Or, for that matter, any other operating system? Is your hardware vendor still supporting your backup destination along with the hardware? Will new applications require different backup add-ons and backup types? If you don't plan for all that now, then you'll find yourself back in the same position down the road. Or even worse, you'll just assume your mission-critical data and systems are still protected until a disaster strikes you and you've discovered otherwise. The best backup solution will always give you flexibility to expand your horizons and continue protecting your mission-critical data as required. Take the time to review where your information data will be in the future, both ideally and realistically, what different backup requirements it may have, and how these can best be addressed. Your future self will thank you. Once you've got all the above questions sorted out, you'll finally be able to start thinking about which hardware-software combinations will best fit your needs. And, of course, that's where the fun really begins. From Marty Winston, with his segment on All Hands on Tech, Turning 21. Marty Winston's report, Turning 21, is about how many ways things in tech and in life will turn around as we turn the calendar page to 2021.
Well, this is the final show for 2020. A year of unwelcome leisures, diminished treasures, denied pleasures, extreme measures, and overmuch hooey and phooey. But all bad things come to an end. So grab your calendar, Enough of the badness of plenty that plagued 2020. It's time to turn 21. 21. It's the age of adulthood, of growing out of the restrictions of childhood and into the real world. Hey, no one will find it challenging to list things not to like about 2020. And a ball dropping at Times Square isn't a magical device, but still, we can all anticipate that 2021 will lead to more that's light and less that's darkness. 2021 is the year when the pandemic will end. Enough vaccine will get distributed by the end of January to get a first shot to one out of every four Americans. Businesses will find a new normal that by the end of the year will more closely resemble the old normal, may even improve it. Everyone can see that many concepts about home and work and school are changing, and 2021 could begin an era when that can be thoughtfully applied to evolving those activities. Of course, there's a lot about 2021 that's still going to be different because of the huge drag that 2020 has been in so many parts of life and art and technology and work. For example, right now, this time of year, is when everyone expects a flood of announcements of cool new tech products to emerge from CES exhibitors, eager to get our blood boiling. Not so much this year. Most of the factories where consumer electronics get built are in and around China, where shutdowns happened earliest and recovery is still in process with a long way to go. There seems to be more headphones and earbuds than anything else, except maybe cases. Personal computers and tablets, well, it's a lot like cars. Sure, they're new, but they haven't changed much. And anyway, is buying one of those the best use of your money right now? The same is true for appliances, TV sets, and lighting. There's some cleverness in new tools, but rarely enough to justify replacing what you already have if it works. The first quarter of the year will still be, as it should be, a time of less travel, less commuting, but the slow start to new tech will bring a bonus this fall, kind of a double jump. Designers have been working on some very cool new products that simply couldn't get queued up for the usual spring and summer releases this year. Some of those will start showing up with fascinating features and in thrilling throngs by around Labor Day, which you may come to see as an amazing time, except that you can kick that up another couple of notches in terms of the products that arrive for the holidays. Save what you can during the first part of 21 and build up your credit as much as you can. The last 4 months of the year will feel a little bit like you just took a time machine ride to the future. And watch out for the swindles that will try to take advantage of what's becoming a widespread sense of exit from the pandemic. They could try to sell you on technology gizmos. The least harmful of those are simply ineffective, but many are harmful in any context. And with the pandemic still a current event, likely to make you more rather than less susceptible. Two of our next three reports here will tell you more. The January 6 report is called, If UVC is a color you can't see, why is it a gold rush? And the January 20 report, Coronavirus Ineffective Tech Hall of Shame. One company directly challenged me, asking why I don't, instead of just saying what's wrong with everything, tell them how to do it right. So, here's a full disclosure, and understand there's no basis for me getting rich from this. It should debut in the second half of January. It's a new line of made-in-USA tech products with a different approach to countering contagion. They intercept live virus in real time between the instant an infected person coughs or sneezes or just exhales the virus and the instant when others nearby are likely to inhale it. These products interrupt the path of contagion and render the virus harmless. By the way, an estimated 3 million people in the U.S. are bedridden right now with COVID-19 infections. Every time they exhale live virus. Right now, every time they inhale, they're inhaling some of that live virus. It's a moment of reinfection that increases the virus load. That means the infection gets worse and lasts longer. the least expensive of those new products can help safeguard them from reinfecting themselves. It also helps protect their caregivers. Part of the trick is to focus not on disinfecting spaces, but on getting between faces. And no, it's not a wearable. If you know of any other countermeasures that can intercept live virus in real time, email a link or some other way to look it up. Hank is on the list to get one of these new gizmos for review as soon as they ship. And that's one example of positive change for 2021. Tech that can play a consequential role in flattening the curve. Yeah, 2021 will be a year when it's again reasonable to hope. If 2020 seemed to be a year of losing hope, of hopelessness, of helplessness, then 2021 will be a year of progress, of recovery, of coming out stronger, of seeing ourselves as not just survivors, but citizens of a new frontier. Indeed, new frontiers have been one area where 2020 has seen some positive impacts. Private sector participation in space programs has been exciting, provocative, and promising. We also saw advances in networking, from the backbones to the backwoods, with more wired and wireless reach and speed. Data connectivity has evolved into a key infrastructure element. And during 2020, it's become both more available and more reliable. 2020 was also a year when it became obvious that much of what we long took for granted proved unequal to the strains of a painful year. Education was hard hit. The schools adapted as much through the stubborn determination of committed educators as through any other adaptation. That begs better solutions. The front lines of medical care demonstrated heroism indeed, but also demonstrated a need for deeper levels of planning and support. Even the news media found their historic adherence to self-governance and strong ethical anchors inadequate to deal with all the chaos of the year, whether natural or contrived. If you read between the lines, elements of the U.S. Cyber Command seem to have been overall effective in defending America's data borders, but recent news has shown some cracks in protection, cracks that are probably out away from the Cyber Command's area of responsibility, which suggests that some of those cracks may exist within the internal responsibilities and staffing of impacted government agencies. Perhaps an umbrella watchtower through Homeland Security enhancements can serve that end. Still, the perception persists, as it should, that the terrors of 2020 will not persevere as we turn 21. Turning 21, climbing out of the pits of 2020, reclaiming lost ground, setting a new basis for progress and for hope. As the calendar turns to 2021, of course, we wish you a happy new year. You know, the extra depth of meaning of those three simple words does not escape us. Stay healthy. Stay hopeful. Stay energized by the belief that in 2021, we will all have a happy new year. Next time, before you spend a penny on anything that claims its technology can defend you against the coronavirus, join us as we paint you a quite different picture in our report, If UVC is a Color You Can't See, Why Is It a Gold Rush? Hey, you did make being here every week one of your New Year's resolutions, didn't you?
Thank you, Marty. Public service announcements. Computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. Most of the computer clubs have begun to schedule their general monthly meetings through teleconferencing. For updated information, visit the website of the computer club. New York Amateur Computer Club. Speech recognition presentation, Thursday, January the 14th, 2021 at 7 p.m. Via Zoom virtual meeting. Website is nyacc.org. The following computer clubs haven't finalized their meeting time because of the pandemic and the holiday period. These are their websites that you can go to check when they have scheduled their next meeting. Princeton PC Users Group, ppcug-nj.apcug.org. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group, limac.org. That's limac.org. Westchester PC Users Group, WPCUG.org. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey, that is the ACGNJ.org. And finally, Computer Learning Center at Ewing, they closed up in March and they haven't restarted yet, and they're waiting for the ending of the pandemic to resume meetings. But their website is clcewing.org. That's clcewing.org. That's the Computer Learning Center at Ewing. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We are heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm. If you have any questions for us, just send us an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King, Michael Horowitz, Marty Winston, and Benjamin Rockwell, we thank you for listening. And to all our listeners, we wish you a happy new year. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next Wednesday in the year of 2021.
Forgot.